Okay, so for today's reading, I've chosen to read a recent Dhamma talk by Hajahn Kema Dhammo from England. And Hajahn Pasino mentioned him during the Chalkun ceremony that he was awarded a Chalkun title in 2004 for a lot of his work that he's done with prison service in England. And his ecclesiastical title is Pra Bhavana Vitate. And he was born in England in 1944 and became a summoner at Wat Mahadat in 1971, and then became a fully ordained bhikkhu with the Ajahn Chah at Wat Palpong in 1972. And I thought I would read just one page from Seeing the Way, Volume 2, and then I'll read the recent talk. And I'll just start here with the... So he's talking about how he actually ended up at Wat Palpong. He says, "But I eventually got to Wat Palpong and had been accepted and allowed to stay. I just couldn't at first grasp what was so special about Ajahn Chah, which didn't make me exactly popular with some of the foreign monks who were already there and who had developed a strong faith in him. But then, even before I'd begun to fall under his spell, I did catch on to what he had created, a formidable opportunity, a suitable place and supportive environment, equipped with the effective and powerful tool of the bhikkhu life. Now as I'm getting older, I'm anxious to keep alive the example and tradition that he established. What he taught was not just practical, but revolutionary in its impact. He made the whole business of being a monk really work. In many monasteries and temples, as can easily be seen, the disciplines and the traditions are not upheld, and no one seems to care or to see much point in them. Neither the monks there nor the laity seem to grasp how the monastic discipline and traditions relate to practice and development. But Ajahn Chah understood and made it all work. He was, of course, an exemplary character. He was very kind, epitomizing metta, but firm and unyielding in his principles, and he could be very fiery, turning in an instant into the most terrifying species of monk-eating tiger you can imagine. He expected a good and proper standard to be maintained and accepted nothing less. We had to do our best to fit in, but as foreigners from the West, we were often privileged. And certainly he enjoyed our peculiarities and was amused by our clumsiness and mistakes. But still, he was determined to push us and stretch us, and often it felt more like being thrown into the deep end and expected to swim. He was unique. There have been very few teachers of his stature, and very few traditions have had anything like the impact that he had, especially in such a relatively short time." Then this was a talk that he gave at the Katina this year at Amravati, and it's not 100% edited, so I've changed just a few things because he said he did want to make some edits to it. And he refers to terrorism or war and things like that, and what he's referring to is the recent terrorist attacks and bombings that happened in Paris. And also, too, at that same time, when I was there, especially in Italy, it's like it did seem like you were in a war scene. Like, you know, every subway and bus stops and things like that, there were military around, and the newspapers were all having headlines like "Europe at War" and things like that. So it was a very kind of tense time. Okay, "I quite confidently thought I was coming here for a fairly easy time. I'm at the age when I quite enjoy having an easy time. However, I'm very pleased and honored to be asked to speak to you. I'm not a great talker, so don't expect too much. I won't be keeping you for very long. It's very nice to be here. I enjoy coming to these occasions, and I quite enjoy, too, the connection. As Ajahn Amaro has told you, I came over here with Lumpur Chal and Ajahn Sumedho on what was supposed to have been a 2-month visit. It took me 9.5 years to get back to Thailand. I well remember the day when Lumpur Chal asked Ajahn Sumedho and I together, and he, of course, would have to go back, but we would stay. I must say I was quite pleased, really. We were at the Hampstead Vihara, which was the place where I first discovered Buddhism. At that time, I had known and had been taught by Kapila Wattu, who founded the Sangha, the English Sangha Trust. Before I went to Thailand, I had gone to see him, and he said to me, "You've got to promise to come back. Make sure you come back." So I said yes. I promised I'd come back, so that's what I did. Because Buddhism had meant so much to me, I felt I wanted to make it available, or to have some involvement in making it available in this country. In some small way, I've done that, in particular in the prisons. I didn't seek out to go to the prisons, but rather the prison service back in those days had the Hampstead Buddhist Vihara as their address for all matters Buddhist. So it was in 1977 that suddenly we had letters and phone calls from prisons asking for someone to go and visit their Buddhist prisoners. I was on a train with Lumpur Chaw, and I asked him what he thought. I was a bit nervous about asking him, as I was wondering what he would say. But I asked, and he just said, "Go." So that was it. I've been going to prison ever since. It's been a long sentence. So long, I keep seeing not only the same prisoners again and again on sentence after sentence, but I'm even seeing their sons. I sometimes fear I'm going to die in prison. There has been some great responses from people in prison. Most of the Buddhists in prison have come to Buddhism while in prison. Lately, of course, we've had an influx of Vietnamese, but most of the guys I see, I mostly go to men's prisons, have come to Buddhism while in prison. And it's meant quite a lot to them. Some of them have made enormous changes, at great odds, too. Because they don't have the luxury that you have of being able to come to places like this, Amravati, or to go to bookshops and browse the many books that are now available on Buddhism, and all that kind of thing. They can't do that or look on the internet and see all the stuff that's available there. They can't do any of that. And they don't have the opportunity to encounter a kind of Buddhist culture, as you do. And often their peers and friends ridicule them for what they're doing. But such is their commitment that they keep at it. And this is marvelous. You have to admire the resolve of some of these people, their dedication to practice, to improve themselves, and to make changes. And that, of course, is what we are supposed to be doing with this Buddhist practice, to make changes, some very fundamental and important changes in our lives. Today we have come to celebrate the Sangha. It's a great Sangha occasion. In the prisons, a few years ago, well, it seems to me quite a long time ago, the prison service asked me about what kind of festivals could be permitted. Considering that we have people of different schools of Buddhism, and they only allow 3 festivals a year, I decided I would celebrate the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. So it's fairly easy. We chose Vesakha Puja for the Buddha Day, Asala Puja, the anniversary of the Buddha's first sermon, for the Dhamma Day. And then I decided to have the Pavarana Day, the last day of the Vasa, as Sangha Day. Because of that, I'm very conscious as I go through each year of celebrating and contemplating these 3 jewels. Lately, as I've been going around the jails, we've had some celebrations of the Sangha. So I've been talking to the men about the Sangha, about the Arya Sangha and the conventional Sangha, and the huge debt we have to the conventional Sangha for maintaining and keeping alive the Buddhist dispensation for all these many years. It's no mean feat. Some years ago, I was invited to a meeting about chaplaincy in hospitals. They assumed I knew something about chaplaincy because I had been going to the prisons for all these years. So I went along to this meeting and sat through it. And they started talking about what criteria they should put in place when deciding whether a person was fit to be a Buddhist chaplain. They eventually turned to me and said, "What do you do?" So I said, "Well, we have people fill in a form, and on that form there are some questions like, how long have you been a Buddhist? What kind of Buddhist are you? Would you be willing to facilitate schools of Buddhism other than your own?" Then I said, "There are a couple of questions about the precepts." Suddenly, and this was in an ad hoc group of people from a variety of Buddhist traditions, there was this kind of eruption. This woman, I remember, withered on about, "There are lots of Buddhists who eat meat and drink alcohol." All I'd said was precepts. And I hadn't gone any further than that. I was a bit sort of taken aback. Eventually it simmered down and I was able to carry on. Then someone said to me, "What do you do if someone drinks alcohol?" I said, I don't appoint them. Mayhem. There was this guy from the Buddhist Society in London going on about some famous Zen poet who wrote the most magnificent verse and was drunk all the time. I don't know what that had to do with chaplaincy. I came out of that meeting really quite shocked. I've been around a lot, and I've mixed with some of the most infamous criminals in the country. And so it takes quite a lot to shock me. But I came out of that meeting... But I came out of that meeting quite shocked. I thought, my goodness, Buddhism's only been in this country for 5 minutes, and here we are wanting to not bother with the precepts. So you see what a tremendous achievement it's been by the Sangha to keep Buddhism alive for 2,500 years. It has not been easy. But the Sangha has done a marvelous job. I know that in some places, the Sangha is not in as perfect a condition as it could be. Inevitably, there has been decline. Originally, the Arya Sangha and the conventional Sangha were one. Those first followers of the Buddha who requested the going forth were already Aryas. They were already at least Sotapannas. So in those days, the standards were much higher than we have now. There has been an inevitable decline. But that's the way of it. That's the way of all that is born. It declines. Our bodies decline and eventually pass away. Everything, as the Buddha said, himself said, when he was near the point of death and his follower Ananda was weeping, how could it be otherwise? That which is born should die. And so it is that there is this inevitable decline. But still the Sangha has maintained for this long period of time the Buddhist dispensation. We can benefit. We have it. We have the opportunity that it affords. We can make changes in our lives and improve our lives, be better people. And I'm happy to say that people in prison pick up on that very quickly, because believe you me, having made terrible mistakes, they're very anxious to put those mistakes right, to somehow change themselves and change their lives. There's much more of that happening than you would imagine. I'm happy to do what I can to help them along. So we celebrate the Sangha as the conventional and Arya Sangha. I remember Lumpur Cha saying on one occasion that at the very least you ought to expect to become Sotapanna. I thought, oh my goodness. I hadn't really considered that point very much, attainments and so on. So there it was, what he had said. You should expect to be at least Sotapanna. I think it's important to remember, to remind ourselves of the goal, of the purpose of where all this should be taking us. Otherwise, we can just get lost in the ceremonies and the lifestyle and not really do what we're supposed to be doing. I've been talking, too, about the effect of the Sangha. Kapilavastu was very keen in those far-off days that the Sangha should be established in this country. That's why he founded the English Sangha Trust. He wanted a Sangha here. You know, the presence of a Sangha has an effect because you have these men and women, these people who are doing something very unusual. That unusual work is an inspiration, and it changes the people who come to that place. I noticed that in Thailand, occasionally I did some short walks, tudongs. I didn't do very much of that, but I did do a little bit. During those walks, it was noticeable when you went through a village where there was a good temple. The village was different. It was cleaner, tidier, and the attitude of the people was better. When you went through a village where there was no temple, or there was no activity in the temple, the whole village seems sloppier, dirtier, and not as tidy. It makes a difference to have the presence of the Sangha. You know, we live in a very imperfect world, a world which is constantly expressing its defilements of greed, hatred, and delusion, sometimes in terrible ways. Everyone here is, I'm sure, pretty conscious of what's happened recently in Paris, a terrible expression of these poisons which invade and spoil the minds of all of us. When you have a Sangha, when you have the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha near you, things begin to change and change for the better. When people say to me, what can we do when this sort of thing is happening? When this sort of violence and warfare is around us, what can we do? What can we do? Well, if you're Buddhist, there's a lot you can do. You can do some work on yourselves. That's a major contribution. And to support the presence of the Sangha is another major contribution. It makes changes. It alters the atmosphere. It gives an inspiration to what is good. People often come together for pretty unskillful purposes. It's rare that people come together for what is skillful. I've thought about this particularly when I was in Thailand a couple years ago. I was at Lumpur Cha's Memorial Day. Thousands of people gathered because of something good, fine, and inspiring. Marvelous. And today you've all come here for something good. Marvelous. If you didn't have the Sangha here, you wouldn't be doing this. You'd be off at a football match or watching television or reading something which would be doing no good for your mind. But here you are doing something that's beneficial, not only to you personally, but of course, once you are improving yourself, you are improving your society. You are improving your family. You are improving everything. Marvelous. In light of this violence and unpleasantness, the Sangha is an inspiration. What the Buddha taught, don't lose sight of that. It's very tempting when there is violence, when there is unpleasantness, when people are threatened and hurt, to respond in a similar fashion. We already have heard people say, not only in France, but in other countries too, that the perpetrators, and Muslims in general, should be shot, murdered, and terrible things done to them. And it's in a way understandable. People get hurt, angry, and frightened. These attitudes are understandable, but not right. You just heard from Ajahn Amaro that I live in Warwickshire, in Shakespeare country. It's real Shakespeare country. Shakespeare used to walk on the lane that I live on. He's alleged to have shot a deer just down the road from me. It's a very nice place. I thought, except for deer. I'm not sure deer. But around me as I walk, and I walk quite a lot, I have a personal trainer. He's a four-legged personal trainer. He takes me out every day for exercising. As I go on these training walks, I'm aware of the bomb craters, the old bomb craters in the fields. We are quite close to Coventry. 75 years ago, yesterday morning, Coventry woke up to utter devastation. After 11 hours of aerial bombardment, the city was wrecked. It was a terrible thing. And there around me are these memorials, these bomb craters, bombs that were dropped, let off as the Germans were fleeing the scene. I think about it quite a bit. I was born near the end of the war. I grew up with bomb sites in another part of the country. But you know, Coventry has been rather marvelous because it suffered in that terrible way. And yet though, of course, inevitably the first thought was to fight back. But then later, their thoughts turned towards reconciliation. They have made a really big point of working for reconciliation and for friendship in Coventry. And this is a marvelous thing, because no amount of violence and treating like with like in that way will bring any good. I remember when I was about 8 years old, my father ran a football team. His football team suddenly had invited a German team to come and play. So I'd grown up with this sort of aversion for the Germans, and the only words of German I ever learned were my comics, where, of course, the English soldiers were always beating the Germans, and the Germans were always saying things like Achtung and Himon. That's all I ever learned. I remember sitting at the dining table one day and made some not very nice comment about the Germans, which I suppose I thought was clever of me. And my father, I don't think he actually hit me, but he certainly put me down. Shut up. Enough of that. We don't want any more of that. And that stayed with me, you know. I really respect him for that. That's one of my best memories of my father. Quite right. No, it's over, and you've got to repair. The only way to deal with this hatred and aversion is by not hating. Sometimes asking people to love is a bit much, but you can not hate, not get caught up in more aversion, dislikes, and disharmony. Let's do what we can to bring peace into the world. It will never be a perfect world. We have to acknowledge that. But we can do what we can to make it better. And doing what you are doing here today makes it a bit better. Supporting the Sangha makes it a bit better. Ensuring the Sangha has a place and presence makes it a bit better. Practicing yourself makes it even better. Keeping the five precepts makes it better. Take them seriously because they're very important. I go on all the time, especially with the young people who come to me about that fifth precept, because it's very popular now to breach the fifth precept. People don't like much keeping that fifth precept. Society condones it and thinks that it's part of what you got to do. I used to be an actor, and actors break the fifth precept pretty regular, I can tell you. But there is a terrible danger in breaching it. Go around to our British prisons like me, and you see the harm and damage that breaking the fifth precept has done. People's lives ruined in one night, 1 minute, because of overindulgence in alcohol or drugs or both. So be careful. Keep the precepts, and you will make the world a better place. Keep the precepts, develop loving kindness, and you make the world even better. Do it not just one day, but several days. Try to keep the precepts all the time. Try to keep the mind focusing on virtues like loving kindness and compassion, and you change the world. This is the way. This is the way to defeat all the darkness and unpleasantness. I won't go on too much longer. There are other people you want to hear. But thank you very much for inviting me, and I hope what I've said may be of some use to you and of some benefit. And do just keep coming and keep practicing, and do your very best to make life better for yourself and for all those around you. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Any questions, comments?
I'm wondering if those prisoners, do they run off on Ajahn Kanagamo? Does he, I was wondering how the prisoners affect Ajahn Kanagamo. Is he more, aggressive or anything?
Well, I mean, he is who he is. But he's had this incredible commitment. So he's a really straight arrow. And he's had this incredible commitment to practice and to living his monastic life and living a Buddhist life. So he has an incredible commitment to helping other people. I mean, he actually is the person who set up the whole network of prison chaplains in Britain. And so, he was really the first person to put energy into that and create a network. He has a extreme commitment to setting an example and encouraging others.
Sounds like it.
Oh, yeah. No, he's really an example for so many people. And I think the prisoners relate to him very comfortably. And he empathizes with people who are kind of outside the cultural system. And prisoners can say their bullshit detectors are very high. So some do-gooder coming in wanting to kind of minister to them could just be eaten alive. Now, prisoners really, it's an interesting paradox because it requires an incredible amount of honesty to work with prisoners and within the prison system. And if they detect any kind of condescension or separation, they're not going to respond.
He wrote this in his book. Said, once a year when I'm in Thailand, it's very nice not to have to carry anything for myself. It's jolly nice to be fussed over, and I admit I quite enjoy it. It doesn't happen when I get back, I can tell you. Although Ajahn Mahapo is very caring and has been absolutely brilliant to me in the 10 years he's been with me. But apart from that, when I go to the prisons, I don't get any special treatment. I have to carry my own stuff and put up with people shouting at me, sometimes rude, sometimes witty. In any way, I welcome it. Life is a bit more difficult, but it's all right because it keeps me sharp. I don't want to get flabby.
So where does he live?
Warwickshire. Maybe 2 hours, a couple hours north of London.
Does he It's a monastery, at least.
Yeah, it's a monastery. Yeah, it's a monastery. Himself and another monk. I think there's a nun there, and then a revolving cast of people who come through to help and support. And there's a supporters from nearby towns. He has a network of supporters who come and help look after the place. So, I think one of the things that stands out in my memory of him is this year, when the year that I was on sabbatical and spent a year in retreat in Chippers. Ajahn K. Madanmal had been organized. He did it over a period of years in many of the prisons through England. He organized Buddha images to be brought into the prisons, and they created Buddha groves, corners of the prisons that had Buddha images and gardens. And not just pretty much life size images, sitting images, meditation postures, and had them put in place, and then they had ceremonies, and so I went along to one of the consecration ceremonies, and we spent the day in the prison and sat meditation at the where it was set up, and met with prisoners, and they also one of the things remember one of the prisoners saying, they saw us sitting meditation. And just the fact of somebody sitting still in the midst of the prison, quietly, had this incredible effect on. Because it's, prisons in general are noisy, and you're always, you can't really stop or slow down or be still. It's always this kind of agitation going on, whether it's on the prisoner side or the prison guard side. I mean, it's all very agitating. And then to see somebody just sitting still. Of course, then Ajahn K. Madanmal dealing with one of the people who was the prisoner who led the precepts and asking for the refuges of precepts. Ajahn K. Madanmal, just before the ceremony, Ajahn K. Madanmal realized that he'd been busted for dealing because he got special privileges because he was a Buddhist leader, and he got access to different parts of the prison, and he'd set up a scam of selling marijuana and drugs in a different area. He was able to move around the prison and do these drug deals, and so that all came out in the middle of it. So it's this wonderful thing was happening, and somebody losing the plot and using, being manipulative. That's very, very much the nature of the world, nature of the prisons.
It was interesting to hear that comment about the fifth precept, reaching that for one day, 1 minute, can change your life. You can assume that, but this is hearing from someone who knows, who's actually heard stories.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's the, the reality is that the prisons are filled with people who've Yeah, the decision that they make that put them in prison, either spontaneous or cumulative decisions that have been conditioned by some kind of intoxicant that clouds mindfulness. Whether it's an ongoing addiction or even just some heedlessness that's come about and they've done something incredibly stupid or violent. That's a fairly common denominator within a prison.